This is RT Radio 1. Time now to join Vincent Woods for Arts Tonight.
Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. On the programme, In the Light of Music, composer Raymond Dean on his new memoir and four decades of making new classical music in Ireland. An extract there from Minerva's Owl, one of 12 pieces by composer Raymond Dean on his new album Nocturne, all played by Hugh Tinney. The new album coincides with the release of Dean's memoir, In My Own Light, which traces his development and growth as a composer, his life in Ireland, Germany and Switzerland, studying with Karl Stockhausen along the way, and also details his struggle with alcohol addiction and the part Bloomsday played in his overcoming that addiction. Dean spent part of his childhood in Achill, the family moving to Dublin while he was still a boy. He studied music at UCD and continued his studies in Germany, composing music from early on, with one of his best-known pieces, Embers, written when he was just 20. Raymond Dean's recent work includes the opera The Alma Fetish, which had a concert performance at the National Concert Hall last year. I've been speaking to Raymond Dean about his memoir and his music. First, the new recording, Nocturne, with Hugh Tinney. What inspired this music?
Well, Nocturne was commissioned by that absolutely wonderful pianist Hugh Tinney, with whom I had been working on and off since 1995. So he commissioned a cycle of pieces from me in 2010, and I had had this idea of writing a cycle of some kind or another based on the idea of night and night music, and maybe actually writing it at night. So this seemed the ideal opportunity. So the theme of night is what runs through the 12 pieces, although I ended up writing most of them during the day, which is my normal practice.
And the piece we heard, Minerva's Owl, the first track on, yes, on that album, tell me about that.
Well, the title, very pretentiously maybe, was suggested by Hegel, who wrote that the Owl of Minerva, which is a symbol of wisdom, flies off as evening falls. In other words, you don't really know about something until you reflect about it afterwards. And to me, this related to a kind of sense of afterness in my music, that I often feel my music seems to be reworking materials that are strewn around, that have been kind of left there by past cultures, mainly, I suppose, Western cultures, I'd have to say. The piece is also written on, not in the key of C-sharp minor, which for me, because of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, which I loved as a child, is kind of the key of the night. So that really tells you what you need to know about, more than what you need to know, because really you just listen to the piece.
Music strewn around from older cultures, in a sense that maybe answers something I wanted to ask you about, which is, you know, where for you do you think your music comes from? I know it's a huge question, and for anyone, any artist who makes original work, it's maybe something of a mystery. But I mean, does it ever feel to you like you are tapping into something beyond you, that you are bringing somehow back into life or back into light?
Well, that sounds very mystical, but I think in a non-mystical sort of way. I mean, ever since I was a small child, I've been very steeped in the music, the classical music of Europe in particular. Later, of course, I've broadened out a lot. So I have listened in the course of my life to an awful lot of music. I've loved a lot of music, and I've disliked a certain amount of it. And I do find, very often long after I've written a particular piece, I realize that something went into it from some other composer that I wasn't familiar with at the time. So this is, in a sense, it's our postmodern condition, isn't it, that we really have at our disposal, at our fingertips, such a huge amount of material. And we no longer have the sense of a strong tradition that somehow or other blends this together. So yes, I mean, in a very simple sense, I am reworking what other people have done, but I hope I'm doing it my own way.
Nocturne funded, I suppose, in a rather unusual way, the making of that album.
The making of the album, yes. The actual commission came through the Arts Council. The album I funded through this
great new website.
Yeah, this is something that I really had to be pushed into doing. I mean, when my initial funding application for this fell through, I was practically giving up on the project. And people said to me, "No, you have to go down this crowdsourcing route." And I really didn't want to do it. But I suppose in the end, just wanting to make the album won out over it. So I did. Through Fundit, I launched a campaign for to try and make 6,000 euro in 6 weeks. I ended up making, I think, 7,200 in 6 weeks, but 1,000 of that I put in myself when I got nervous. So you could say that, in fact, it was pretty spot on. It was a very difficult thing for me to do because it's something you have to nurture. You have to be working on it every single day. You have to keep your project before the eyes of the public. And you feel a little bit like somebody standing out there holding out your hat the whole time with the rain pelting down on you. You know, it went very much against the grain. But I'm very grateful to the large number of people who contributed towards it. It was a wonderful manifestation of kind of solidarity. Yeah.
Do you have any idea what sort of people, you know, who donated, who made?
I have a very good idea because it turns out I know most of them. If not personally, I know them through Facebook quite often. A rather surprising number of people who are political activists, whom I know through the political world, contributed as well. Very few of the, I can't remember how many, it was over 100 contributors, would be people whose names are completely strange to me. And very few, only a small percentage of those, a reasonable percentage, would be actual musicians, people whom I know to be classical music lovers.
And this whole landscape is changing so rapidly, the opportunity to raise funds in this way. In one way, it must be invigorating, maybe a little bit exciting. Another way, it must be maybe slightly unnerving to think that there is such a pace of change that may be hard to keep up with.
Well, there is that side to it. There is also, as with so many things, exactly the opposite side to it, that in another sense, it's a kind of regression. It's part of the general return to Victorian values. I mean, our Minister for Culture talks about philanthropy. Suddenly, public funding of the arts is not something that the state is going to take much interest in, and we are all going to go down the philanthropic route. Well, we're back in the 19th century with that, you know.
And of course, you know, we've seen these massive cuts to the Arts Council budget.
Yes.
And it's something we're going to look at on this program in a while. But serious implications for artists across the board. And I often think that for composers, it may be particularly difficult because you don't have the same opportunity to maybe make money from your music that we'll say in the way that filmmakers may have, or even some writers have.
Yeah, well, I can't speak for filmmakers or writers. They certainly have their own problems now as well. Composers are very much dependent. They're almost totally dependent on commissions. And commissions in this country come predominantly through the Arts Council. There's no two ways of saying that. Once that is reduced, composers are in trouble. With regard to something like Fundit, for an old geezer like me, I mean, I'm over 60, it's something quite difficult to handle. But I suspect that for younger composers, they would take that much more in their stride because they're kind of clued in to this whole idea of doing something through social media and all the rest of it. But I would hate to think that they would thereby think that this is a natural state of affairs and that they would stop somehow or other becoming activists for continued public funding for the arts.
Let's have a listen to another piece of music. One of your very early pieces, Embers, written in 1973. So you were 20. And you write in the memoir that you had reached a point of almost dismissing this work until you began to listen to it again and heard and saw the depth and significance of it.
That's right. I wrote it for a group of musicians, a string quartet led by the late Charlie Maguire, who was a viola player. And these were great musicians, but they didn't have much experience in contemporary music. So I thought I would write a piece that would be fairly simple to play. Of course, it's not simple. It has its own kind of of difficulties. And I was under the impression that this was just something I was doing on the side prior to being able to write the big complicated things I really wanted to write. It took me 20 years to realize that I was already on the right path. And to realize it was when I the Duke Quartet, a British quartet, did a tour of Ireland and included Embers. And I went around at them and I listened to it six or seven times in succession that I realized that this piece, in fact, contained, in a nutshell, just about everything I've ever tried to do subsequently. It's something I've been trying to live up to for the last 40 years, which is disconcerting.
An extract there from Embers by Raymond Dean, our guest on tonight's Arts Tonight. Raymond, how do you work best? I mean, we've talked there earlier about commissions, and you know, do you work best to commissions? Does the music come in intense, concentrated periods, or are you somebody who works kind of steadily, daily, sits down and tries to get some amount out every day?
No, I'm certainly not the latter. I mean, music keeps coming, whether you like it or not, because somehow or other that's the way you're tuned. So I have notebooks that are full of musical ideas, which is pretty normal. But it is the case that when there is a definite something to work towards, and in particular a particular performance, a particular commission, that really concentrates you. It really gives you an incentive and the feeling that what you're doing is something that is wanted, and that is very important to me. I mean, Stockhausen, with whom I, in quotation marks, studied for a while, always said, oh, you can't write music for the drawer. In other words, just write music. But I know composers who do write music for the drawer because they're compulsive composers. I'm not a compulsive composer. That's probably why I do a lot of other things as well as composing. Composition is really the kind of central thread in my life.
Stockhausen, you mentioned there, and you did, in inverted commas, study with him. And you referenced this in the memoir, In My Own Light. And I suppose in a way that happened almost accidentally. You'd actually gone to Germany to study with somebody else.
Yes, I'd gone to Germany to study with Maurizio Kagel, who was an Argentinian composer living in Cologne. He was one of the teachers of Gerald Barry, and it was Gerald who had suggested that I apply to him. I did, and he accepted me. And I had one lesson with Kagel, after which Stockhausen's assistant came and visited me at home and said, would you prefer to work with Stockhausen? And I said, well, I would really, but I haven't applied or anything. And Kagel would be offended. And this guy said, oh, don't worry about Kagel. And he looked at a few of my scores and he said, OK, right, you can study with Stockhausen if you like. So very rudely, I then abandoned Kagel, who never forgave me for it, and went and, quotation marks again, worked with Stockhausen. Whether that was a good idea, I think it probably wasn't, but, you know, it happened.
What was he like as a teacher?
He wasn't. He wasn't a teacher. He was a teacher in a kind of Old Testament sense, or perhaps in a medieval sense. He saw himself as a master, who had apprentices, and he bemoaned the fact that nowadays it wasn't acceptable that composers would regard themselves as an apprentice for 40 years before producing their first compositions as masters. And that whole mentality was rather inimical to me. So he just talked about himself. And of course, it was important. It was very interesting. It was also very annoying. And he was not a very endearing individual. And in fact, one result of studying with him for a fairly short period, it was only about 7 or 8 months, was that I stopped listening to his music completely and only started listening to it again a few years back, and slowly began to recover my respect for a great deal of it, not all of it.
I think as a young musician and composer, you were a bit shocked at the rivalry, almost animosity you encountered, you know, between these great composers.
Yeah, I'm certainly seeing it from Stockhausen's perspective. He used to say things that I thought were really infantile about his colleagues, people like Kagel or Pierre Boulez or Henri Poussin. He didn't just not have a good word to say for them, but he would say really sarcastic things about them and then purse his lips. He had a particular kind of sarcastic smile that I remember very vividly. And I found that kind of shocking. But, I mean, you realise that these great people are just human beings and they have their trivial areas like anybody else.
The memoir, In My Own Light, you know, mixture of raw honesty about yourself and your personal struggle in surviving alcohol addiction and a fascinating insight then into your music and the whole business of being a composer of classical music in Ireland. Why did you want and choose to write this story now?
Well, I've always written, you know. I sometimes wonder whether it was just a chronological accident that I became a composer rather than a writer. But again, that kind of speculation is futile. I've always written. I did publish a novel in 1992, I think it was. And at a certain point, you know, thinking a lot about this whole thing of overcoming addiction, touch wood, trying to understand why all these things happened in the first place and how it happened that I kind of snapped out of it, I decided I would write this memoir as an attempt, a kind of auto-analysis, to see if I could work out what the hell had been going on. I don't think I really succeeded, but I did succeed in writing a book, which is a nice thing, and putting out, in a sense, some of the evidence and let other people try to work out for themselves if it makes any sense, you know.
The novel, sort of, I suppose, mock gothic, but I think still with quite a following.
Yeah, it's kind of postmodern, mock gothic farce, really. I think at the time it sold about 400 copies. I fell out with the publisher, which didn't help. So he did nothing to disseminate the book. But it has been leading a kind of subterranean existence ever since. And I keep being surprised by people who say that, you know, they've just read it. And a film company recently approached me to say they might be interested in making a film of it. We'll see how that happens. I mean, 20 years ago, there were several such false alarms that came to nothing. But it would be a nice thing to see happen.
And that novel, Death and the Medium, is there any connection between that and any of the music at all?
Well, I mean, the central character is a failed composer.
So there might.
No, I don't want to say that's a self-portrait. It's a self-parody. There's no doubt about it. Oscar Wilde said, "You always kill the thing you love." I always parody the thing I love, and I suppose I love myself up to a point. So there's a lot of self-mockery in the book. There are a lot of references to music in it, but again, it's not to be taken hugely seriously. It was a rather satirical venture.
Going right back, as you do in the memoir, In My Own Light, growing up on Achill, those the first years, and I suppose being encouraged, strongly encouraged to play piano by your parents, your mother, I think, in particular. But your sister, Patricia, I think, responsible for your first commission and the first piece performed in public.
Yeah, well, Patricia actually played a very important role because she was 3.5 years or so older than me, and it was kind of listening to her playing and being a competitive little brat. I thought, well, God, I can do that. I bet you I can do that. And I remember learning to read music from my mother and being really shocked to find that once you'd learned to read it, you couldn't just sit down at the piano and play it, that was a totally separate process and you had to learn that all over again. But nonetheless, I eventually did learn to play some of the same things I'd heard Patricia playing. Later on, as you say, this would be when I would be about 14, she was in Loretto the Green, and she had taken up the clarinet, and she was playing in I think it was a Christmas concert, and she asked me to write a piece for her, and I wrote a mazurka in D minor, and that was my first appearance in public as a composer. It was a pretty dreadful little piece, but the pianist, she actually learned it with Coleman Pierce at the piano, who later on would, in fact, conduct a lot of my work and, in fact, conducted the recordings of my first CD of orchestral music.
So you seem to have known from really early on that you would compose music and that this is what you wanted to do?
Yeah, well, I made the decision and it was a formal decision. I kind of stood and looked out the window of the house in Acklin and said, I'm going to be a composer at the age of 10. You know, I mean, there's something really absurd about making a decision at the age of 10 and sticking to it all your life, particularly when your first attempts at composition are pretty risible. I describe in the memoir how I played a little piece for one of our maids. We used to have maids because both my parents worked, and I thought she would say to me, "That's wonderful, who wrote that?" Instead of which she sniffed and said, "You wrote that yourself, didn't you? It's all right."
She wasn't going to be too impressed by it.
No, she was distinctly unimpressed.
We won't play any of that early music for the early music videos, but we will play a piece from a later work, Crespel's Concerto, from 1984, I think. What inspired that concerto?
Well, the original piece in 1983 actually was a kind of radio opera and was commissioned by RTE as their Italia Prize entry, which is for radiophonic works. And it wasn't really a radiophonic work at all. It was, as I say, a radio opera based on the story Crespel by E.T.A. Hoffmann, which is used in the opera The Tales of Hoffmann. And I use some of the music from The Tales of Hoffmann as really the basis from which the work is constructed. The original opera was a kind of a homage to the 19th century, a kind of ambivalent homage to the 19th century. It involved speakers, soloists, chorus, orchestra and tape. So then in, I think, around about 1991 or thereabouts, 1990 maybe it was, I was asked to provide an orchestral composition to open a festival called the Accents Festival, organized by my friend Fergus Johnston. So I made this version for violin and orchestra without any voices of the piece. It kind of sticks to the overall shape of the opera, but is rather shorter.
From Crespel's Concerto there by Raymond Dean. Raymond Dean, were you aware particularly of traditional music as a young man? You know, was that around? Was it an influence at all for you, or was it something you consciously almost rejected?
I wasn't particularly aware of it as a child in Achill, which is rather strange because I presume it must have been around somewhere, but I just wasn't. As I say, I was completely saturated, first of all in classical music and then in pop music, the Liverpool scene. I was really sucked up by the Beatles and Rolling Stones and the rest. So I didn't pay any attention to traditional music until I went to university. In fact, it was Saoirse Bodley who taught Irish music there, who alerted me to the riches of the music itself and of the performance techniques behind it. But I never really became a composer whose work recognizably uses traditional materials. Some people have been quite critical of me for that, but I don't think one is under any moral obligation to use any particular kind of materials. I love the music. I listen to it when I get an opportunity, and it certainly has filtered into certain works and probably will continue to do so.
The time, you know, studying in Switzerland briefly and then in Germany, working with even if it was, in inverted commas, with Stockhausen, studying with him. How important was that for you? How important was it for you to I suppose, engage in that wider European and international world of music and music composition at that time?
Well, unfortunately, as I make pretty clear in the memoir, I didn't really engage. I went to Switzerland.
You were there.
Yeah, I studied with a very nice man called Gerald Bennett, who was head of the conservatoire in Basel at the time and was himself a pupil of Pierre Boulez. Later on, I was with Stockhausen and then finally with Isang Yun, the late Isang Yun, in what was then West Berlin. These were three wonderful opportunities for me, which I just, with hindsight, deliberately dismantled, destroyed, didn't avail of. That's the negative way of looking at it. The positive way of looking at it was that it was something I had to go through. It was good to get out of Ireland. It was good to try, even if unsuccessfully, to adapt myself to these different countries with which I've had much closer links later on in life. But certainly, as for making use of the opportunities they offer, I didn't do so. I did attend performances of works that I would have known about or that I would have heard on radio. It was good to hear them live. But you must realize that as a fanatical listener to the BBC, the third programme, I was very, very familiar with this music anyway. And I spent a lot of my pocket money on I almost said CDs, on records of Stockhausen and Boulez and the rest of them. Everything I could get my hands on, everything I could afford to get my hands on, everything I could listen to through terrible reception, I listened to. So, you know, it wasn't that I was suddenly being exposed to something that was unfamiliar to me.
You're listening to Arts Tonight. My guest is composer Raymond Dean, whose memoir, In My Own Light, has just been published. Back in a moment.
RTE Radio 1.
This is Arts Tonight, and this is from Passage Work by Raymond Dean. Crash Ensemble there with Passage Work by Raymond Dean. Raymond, tell me about that particular piece.
Yeah, that piece is something of an exception in my output for two reasons at least. One reason is that it uses electronics. I have never been an electronics composer, not because I have anything against the idea of electronic music or electroacoustic music. On the contrary, it's probably largely because I can barely change a bulb. Putting a plug into a socket, I always feel, is a major achievement. And I worked on the electronics for that with Jürgen Simpson, who was absolutely indispensable to me. The other reason why it's exceptional is because it is, in a very sort of general way, an explicitly political piece. You know, although I've been involved in political activism for many years, I've tended not to write political music, except in the sense that maybe everything one does can be analysed from a political perspective. This piece originally had a subtitle, Landscapes of Exile 1. It's a title taken from a poem by Bertolt Brecht. And the text is a collage from people like Neruda, Machado, Paul Celan, Walter Benjamin, who gives it its title, and Mahmoud Darwish, and they're all things to do with exile and with the exile as a product of political violence. And there's a lot of violence in the piece as well, a kind of evocation of catastrophe, of political catastrophe that kind of evens out in the end. So in that sense, it's one of my more explicit pieces.
We'll talk a little bit more about that sort of strand of politics in your life later. But something I want to talk to you about is opera and opera in Ireland in particular. You know, you have written for opera. And looking at the state of opera here, and it's something we've addressed on this programme, looking at the state of opera here at the moment, state of flux, to put it mildly, for the last few years. There is OTC and they do great work. There is Wide Open Opera and I was delighted to see their Nixon in China recently. There is Northern Ireland Opera, but there's no national opera company as such in the Republic. And it strikes me that that must be very depressing to you and fellow composers of opera in Ireland.
Well, it's one of the wonderful paradoxes of recent years is that while the whole opera infrastructure, such as it was, and it wasn't up to much, as you have hinted, at a time when that infrastructure has collapsed, is in flux, whichever way you want to put it, it seems to be precisely the time when a whole load of composers have suddenly decided they want to write operas. Again, it's that kind of perverse thing of being a composer. You don't always do what seems most practicable. For myself, you know, I've worked with Opera Theatre Company. My first two operas were commissions from Opera Theatre Company. And the most recent opera, the full-scale one, The Alma Fetish, started off as a commission from Lyric FM. And in one sense, I have been very, very lucky. But of course, in another sense, what bothers me about this isn't just the question of the relationship between Irish composers and opera. It's the whole question of all the operas that have never been performed in this country. Modern classics like Alban Berg's Wozzeck, which was supposed to be performed this year, something that fell through, or Berg's Lulu, Schoenberg's Moses and Aaron, works by Britton Tippett. You name it, these pieces are standard in every other country in Western Europe, certainly in every other EU country in Western Europe, and have never been performed in Ireland. It's mind-boggling, and it continues to be mind-boggling. Now, one has to realize that there are people out there like Fergus Scheele of Wide Open Opera and others who are very intent on trying to rectify the situation, and they have been doing really heroic work. But it is an extraordinary situation, and I repeat that it's mind-boggling, and it needs a huge injection of funds, and this is probably not the best time in our history to be talking about huge injections of funds into the arts.
Your own recent opera, The Alma Fetish, which had a concert performance in the National Concert Hall last year. Again, you know, while it's wonderful to have that, I always regret not seeing a full-scale production of an opera. Nonetheless, that must have been gratifying to at least hear it in public, performed in public.
Well, it was more than gratifying. It was probably the best experience I've had in my professional life, in one sense, because it is the largest project I've ever undertaken. And from an early point, after after one scene of it had been commissioned by Lyric, and then the possibility of commissioning further, the rest of the opera fell through. And I had to make this agonizing decision whether to continue with it or just dump it. And I decided to continue with it. And I kind of worked away, beavered away at it for the best part of 5 years, during which time I didn't go looking for other commissions and kind of got into financial trouble and so on. And I was getting quite depressed about the whole thing. And then, again, it was Fergus Scheele who took it in hand and put on this performance. Now, as you say, it was a concert performance. It was an enhanced concert performance. There were a lot of visual elements. And I thought it was quite beautifully done. And in a sense, because I hate most opera productions I see, I hate the productions. I hate the whole idea of director's opera, in which some character who has a particular conception that is usually totally out of tune with the work concerned gets to dominate the way that work is presented to the public. All of that fell away in this concert performance. There was just enough visual material there, as it were, to help your imagination, to help the viewer and listener to make their own production in their heads, as it were. And everybody worked together on this in the most extraordinarily united way. So from that point of view, from every point of view, it was a wonderful experience.
Discourse around opera and music in this country as well. You know, obviously, you know, Lyric FM is there. We hear a small amount of new classical music, Irish music on Lyric. But apart from that, we don't get to hear very much on the airwaves. And then in terms of reviews and discussion, Journal of Music, a little, Irish Times, occasional reviews. But all in all, there's very little written about and very little talk about and little enough of this music played. Does that depress you?
Well, it used to depress me because it was a lot worse a long time ago. Having said that, I would have to qualify it. When I started out in the early 70s, there was actually a great surge of interest in this kind of new music. So in one sense, it was a good and rather deceptive time to be starting out because it looked as though everything was going to be hunky-dory. The fact that things where they are now, that there have been so many false starts, so many things have collapsed, it is quite depressing. A lot of people are doing it for themselves, which is the important thing. Younger composers are getting together, are setting up, whether in the Association of Irish Composers or the Irish Composers Collective. They're putting on public performances of their work. They don't have the kind of support that we had back in the 70s, but they do get support. So there is stuff happening. There are musicologists now in Ireland who are taking an interest in the music of living composers as well as the music of very long dead composers, and that's encouraging. So the scene isn't entirely negative, but it is a constant struggle, and it does require, in my view, the composer to be an activist as well as a composer.
Let's hear a little from the opera, from the Alma Fetish. Tell me briefly about it.
The Alma Fetish was Pauline Buick, the artist, actually suggested the subject, which coincidentally turned out to be one that I had already been considering, and it is that of the relationship between the painter Oskar Kokoschka and Alma Mahler, the widow of the composer Gustav Mahler. They had a stormy, passionate relationship around the time of the First World War. She dumped him. He was almost killed in the war, into which she had pushed him. And afterwards, he had this doll made in her image. The doll then became a kind of catalyst whereby he overcame the destructive effects of this relationship and kind of came back into the world. So that's the subject of the opera.
Idea, divine maker of human forms. I wish you to make me a doll, such a doll, such a doll, as I shall describe. And this doll, and this doll, and this doll shall be alive.
Look at him writing, writing, writing!
With all your skills, start deep within. Make me a doll, make me a doll, make me a doll, make me a doll as I describe it. And the doll, my dear maker, shall be alive. It rests by its force, everything that holds hands, enduring advance, yes, hands. I'll give you the addresses and the sizes from her neck down to her feet, everything correct. We'll need night out and evening wear and sun for ride. She and her robe for days are being. I know we can get it, but tough was made for her. The shop I remember. Oh, Ulta, prepare to meet Alma.
From the Alma Fetish by Raymond Dean. Raymond, music education in Ireland, and I speak as somebody who really had no music education but came to a love of music by myself, I suppose, largely through listening and through, I suppose, one teacher who played classical music for us even though we couldn't study music. I hope things have changed since then, but have they changed enough? And is there, in your opinion, sufficient attention paid and resources given to music education in schools here?
Well, the simple answer is no, and this is really the root cause of all the other problems. Well, one of the root causes of all the other problems. problems. The other root cause would be capitalism, but let's not get into that. Of all the problems we have in the Irish musical world, it's simply not taken for granted that people should learn music in school from a very early age and should learn musical appreciation. This is not unique to Ireland, but certainly in a European context, you look at countries like Germany and France, where not alone is there much more infrastructure for music in general, but there is a much greater emphasis on musical education from an early stage as part of an overall balanced education. My piece, Sea Changes, is on the Leaving Cert certificate, alternating with the piano quartet by Gerald Barry. People are being taught these pieces quite often by very well-intentioned teachers. I'm certainly not belittling teachers here. They're really doing a great work against the odds. But very often they themselves haven't had a very comprehensive musical education. So you have, in one sense, the blind leading the blind quite often. And the idea that this music can be presented just completely out of context to people who have no background in modern music, because this music doesn't come out of a vacuum. It comes out of a background, whether in reaction against it or as part of a tradition. And for people not to be taught that background, not to be taught that tradition, it's absurd. And it brings in its wake the generalized ignorance about music in this country, the fact what we said about opera is also bound up with that. People simply won't go to something if they see an unfamiliar name attached to it. That's a really sad state of affairs.
Your memoir details a struggle with alcohol addiction, and it's a very honest and moving account of that time in your life. And you're very clear about no longer making or accepting the excuse of the sensitive artist outside of society, misunderstood and in need of the sort of crutch and solace of alcohol. And it's, I have to say, it's rare to read anybody, and maybe in particular an artist, giving such an honest account of that.
Well, artists aren't the only sensitive people out there. Let's be clear. And certainly artists aren't the only people who use alcohol and other drugs as a crutch. It may be possible to be an active alcoholic and to be a writer, or to be an active alcoholic and be a painter. I don't think it's possible to be an active alcoholic and be a composer, because the two activities just seem so totally at odds with one another, and the kind of concentration you need for composition is of a nature that is inherently interfered with by the dulling and muddling of the senses that occurs from alcohol abuse. It's remarkable, if you look at the history of classical music, how few significant composers were actually alcoholics, as opposed to the other arts, where I think a great many of the famous practitioners were. You would think of maybe Mussorgsky, Sibelius, and in neither case was it a very good thing, because Mussorgsky didn't manage to finish most of his works and died young, and Sibelius stopped composing, 30 years before he died, never managed to finish his Eighth Symphony. So, the two things don't go together at all.
What seems remarkable in reading the book is that through those years, you were still a young man when you stopped drinking, but the drinking did not seem to affect your work at the time, and you continued to make remarkable new music through all those years.
Well, I did, but I never composed while I was drinking, so to speak. I would go on the dry whenever there was work to be done. And when I look back, I see, it's very hard to pinpoint this now, but I can see the ways in which working in this way, working kind of sporadically between bouts of drinking, and also the kind of distorted mental perspectives that you have, I can see the way that affected the music, that there is a difficulty in drawing together different aspects of the work that I would only overcome when I stopped drinking completely. That said, I'm sometimes amazed by some of the works that I did produce during that time, because quite often Pieces I would write during the very lowest phases would be the pieces that would show least sign of that. They would be the most exuberant and lively. There are a couple of exceptions. But generally speaking, there was that strange dichotomy between the kind of life I was leading and the kind of music I was producing. I mean, all the discipline of which I'm capable, and I'm capable of a certain amount, went into the music, and my actual everyday life was just chaos.
And your last alcoholic drink taken, Bloomsday 1988, yes. And a remarkable story told in the book, that drink costing you one 1904 penny.
That's right. It was a certain public house, Kennedy's, which has symbolic significance, and that was also one of the very first pubs I drank in habitually. Kennedy's of Westland Row had an offer of a pint of Guinness for one 1904 penny because of Bloomsday. And so I gathered myself up a fistful of 1904 pennies. I probably borrowed the money to do that and went to Kennedy's and then found they would only allow one drink. And somehow the absurdity of that situation that I found myself in, it was somehow inexplicably perhaps the trigger that just made me realise, like, come on, get off it. This is just too absurd. Stop. You know, and I went straight from that pub to St. Patrick's House for Fools and Mad, as its founder Jonathan Swift called it, and never looked back, except I looked back all the time.
And you look back very effectively in the book. More music, your oboe concerto from 1993?
1993 to 1994, yeah.
Tell me about it.
It's a piece that was commissioned by RTE, again, for Matthew Manning, who was their principal oboist at the time. I started work on it just after my first trip to the Middle East. I had gone with my sister to Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Israel. And that was a real eye-opener of an experience. And in a sense, that trickled into this piece where the soloist is not a kind of strutting hero, but is an exile. The idea of the soloist as exile. And in this case, you had the lead oboist of the orchestra catapulted out of his seat in the orchestra and somebody else sitting in it. So it became a kind of symbolic piece. Again, it's a piece, I suppose, about exile, like passage work.
From Raymond Dean's Oboe Concerto. Raymond Dean, your involvement in like the cause of Palestinian rights, I suppose, has at times taken you into a realm of controversy over, for instance, your support for a campaign for an artistic boycott of Israel. If we take the music alone and the work of Daniel Barenboim and the East-West Divan Orchestra, surely that's an example of the power of engagement rather than boycott. And don't we all need to engage as artists and as human beings if there is to be hope of peace and new structures and justice and all the things that I think most people want?
Yeah, well, I won't discuss the Barenboim thing here. I've actually written at length about it. You can Google my lengthy article about the East-West Divan Orchestra or the West-East Divan Orchestra. Certainly engagement is very, very important, but there is actually no engagement involved in something like the Divan Orchestra. It's entirely an optical illusion, a mirage. The boycott campaign that you refer to is not a boycott of Israeli artists. It's not a boycott of Israeli art or of Israeli music. It is a boycott of anything that has the financial support of the Israeli government and that can be used as propaganda for the regime. That distinction has to be made very, very strongly. People like myself, and my activism now is at a very low level. I don't do a great deal of it. I'm trying to phase it out, in fact, as much as I can. But we engage all the time. I mean, nobody engages with Israelis, for example, more than people who are Palestinian rights activists. We engage with similarly minded people in Israel who are actually a very tiny minority. It's not, again, another one of these mirages that there is a huge constituency opposed to what the Israeli government is doing. There is not. There's something like 80% of Israelis who fully support what is going on. So, yes, engagement, but let's not have illusions and let's not have a mirage of engagement.
Do you regret the controversy with Dervish at all, for instance?
Oh, yeah, that was a complete that was a fiasco. It was totally unnecessary as well. It was one of these things that happen periodically and that are picked up and exploited by malicious people, and the abuse of what happened with Dervish back 2 years ago, I think, was entirely malicious, and it was entirely, that's what people don't realise, also it was part of a political campaign that was exploiting Dervish for the ends of Israeli propaganda.
Well, I suppose that's one way of looking at it, and others might see it differently. Your brother, John F. Dean, is a very highly regarded poet, founder of Poetry Ireland, and like yourself, a member of Éisteddfod. Do you share his love of poetry?
Well, I share a love of poetry, certainly, with him. I don't know whether we love the same poetry. We probably love some of the same poetry. But yes, I mean, I've been reading poetry all my life.
And, of course, I think there's a good deal of poetry running at times through the music.
Well, I have, I have certainly set quite a few of the poets whom I love. Perhaps not all that much, because I often think really great poetry lives on its own and doesn't need music, or in fact sometimes is kind of distorted by having music attached to it. So the setting of texts to music in the traditional sense is not something that I often do, although I have done it.
Let's finish with another piece from the new album, Nocturne. Tell me about this track, Terzengang.
Terzengang, it's a German term meaning a run of thirds, which is, it's a technical thing for pianists. Some of the pieces in Nocturne do not explicitly deal with this nocturnal theme, particularly some of the later pieces where I thought, well, okay, the nocturnal context has been set. This is a piece that takes one interval. I don't want to get too technical, the major third. And it's a cousin, as it were, the minor third, and just bases the entire piece on interlocking thirds. It's a technical exercise. It's a study. It's a very exuberant piece. And certainly I can't play it myself, even though I'm a pianist, but Hugh Tinney can, and he makes a wonderful job of it.
Thank you. Terzengang by Raymond Dean, and In My Own Light, a memoir by Raymond Dean, is published by the Liffey Press, available now. His new album, Nocturne, is also out and available by going to iTunes and putting in Raymond Dean Nocturne. And by the way, a full itemised list of all the music featured on tonight's programme can be found on our website, rte.ie/radio1/artstonight. That's it from us. Join us again next Monday night at 10. Till then, good night.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, is produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions.